Welcome to the Natural History Cupboard. Come on in.
And welcome back to the Natural History Cupboard podcast, the place where the weird and wonderful parts of the natural world come together. I'm your host, Gareth, and with me as always is my co-host, Aaron. Aaron, say hi.
You've managed to drag yourself away from Path of Titans, I see.
I have, yes.
Well, I mean, in the least jealous tone I could manage there.
So I was going to say, what have you been up to this week? But clearly you've been just jealous of the fact that I've gone and got a new computer game.
It does look really good. I can't wait to play that with you.
I will say it is really good. It took me a while to get the coordination for using a keyboard again to play a computer game as opposed to console. My fingers were hurting at the end of it by like trying to stretch. Like,
why
you know,
don't you just plug your Xbox controller into your computer?
Because I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, so, you can.
All right, maybe I'll have to do that. We learn new things. But no, it's a really good game. But I've not. I've played. I've only had a couple of evenings to play on it.
You've been manifesting your desire to be a haptic Opteryx, haven't you?
Yeah, that was one of the first ones that I went for, but I hadn't fully learned how to take off.
Okay.
So, because I was still getting used to all the buttons and everything, my mighty Hatsigopteryx, the largest flying creature that's, you know, ever flown on the earth, which at this point was still a chick, because the whole point of the game is you're a baby, you've got to eat and grow, and you know, then you can dominate everything that's there. Yeah, I was basically bouncing along the ground, trying to find cliffs or something to try and throw myself off to try and fly. And then I thought I would relive one of my favorite Walking with Dinosaurs things ever, the Ballad of Big Al. So I played as an Allosaurus, and that was fine until I found what I thought was an easy meal. Basically another player who was playing as a Dinocyrus.
Right.
This couldn't have been more
the
perfect.
The terrible claw.
As a perfect sort of attack moment. I was still only a juvenile. He was drinking at a watering hole. He was only a juvenile as well. I snuck up. I attacked.
You're griefing people.
No one griefing. The whole point is you're supposed to attack people and eat them, you know. And he was more powerful than me, so he killed me. So it ended badly. Basically, think of it as a death simulator. You start off as a baby dinosaur, or a baby pterosaur, or even you can play as a Sarcosuchus, the giant crocodile relative. And you essentially have to eat and drink. If you don't, you start to die. And I played as a Thalassodromius, which is a species of pterosaur, like Tupandactylus, massive head crest, absolutely gorgeous looking things. Unfortunately, I was finding it very hard to find fresh water on this map. Even though I could fly, I'd figured out flight controls by this point. I just could not find fresh water for food, for love nor money. So I had to just go with the literal next best thing because I was dying, which was to drink salt water. So I was slowly killing myself by drinking salt water until eventually, just out of nowhere, there was a lake in the distance. I spent far too long around that place because I then couldn't find food. So it's just this almost awful cycle of trying to find food or water. But on your own. But if you're playing in a group, I imagine it's probably a lot nicer. Although it's quite nice flying over the map as a pterosaur, because you can see all of these people trying to kill each other down below, all these tyrannosaurs and triceratops duking it out. You know, you can hang around and wait until one of them kills the other one and then grab a bit of food or something. But yeah, it's a bit too dangerous to go down on the ground.
It's about, if I remember right, there's 18 species in this game that you can opt on.
It's not a bad game. I'll say that much. It was a bit of fun, and I will play it. Like I say, you need to get it, Aaron, so we can both play it. maybe even try and do some sort of attempt at a video. I know how well that goes for us. And go with that. But what have you been up to other than being jealous of me playing a computer game?
Well, I've not been actively up to much, really. I've just been catching up with Atta and my little girl because they come back from Spain. We went off to see some friends in Liverpool. But what I have been doing that has been interesting is a new red kite has taken over a bit of unclaimed territory. So on my way to work and on my way back, I've just been taking a bit of time to observe him every day, him or her, sorry.
And you need to be getting some photos.
Actually, yeah, I don't know why I haven't thought of that, but yeah.
Yeah, why haven't you done?
It's a lovely, he's positioned himself on in a really great spot. It's a very steep valley with a little river winding down it. And on the kind of northwest edge of this little river is some fields with some tree, a little bit of tree coverage, a young tree coverage. And so there's like perfect kind of hunting kind of territory there for him. Again, assuming it's a male, I don't have a clue. Sorry. But it's been very nice to watch the red kite move in.
You need to go and get some photos.
Yeah, I shall try.
Good, good. On the subject of nature spotting things, I've not had much success on anything this week, but my parents had an interesting moment on Anglesey where and they were telling me about this and saying that if they'd have only had the dash cam on their car, they'd have caught the whole thing on video. And I said, that's wonderful, but I can't really put up non-existent video on the Facebook page. But they had a buzzard catch and kill a red squirrel right in front of them.
Wow.
Yeah. Cool. Like a real swoop down, boomf, gone sort of moment. But unfortunately, the dash cam was not on, which is annoying because that would have been a very interesting video to have seen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not so wonderful for the squirrel.
No.
But shall we foray into the news before ourselves get picked off by a metaphorical buzzard?
Let's do it.
It's the news!
Right, well, we're into this week's news. Aaron, what have we got on our newsreel?
Every week, we are inundated with news coming out of the weird and wonderful world of natural sciences. And though we are but a small team, we want you, our fellow cupboard dwellers, to be kept up to date on the good, the bad, and the extraordinary. So let's open up our natural history cupboard newsreel, where we've compiled some of the more interesting headlines and where to find them.
Up first this week, I've got from Monga Bay, bonobos and chimps recall friends and family even after years apart, study has suggested. An experiment with bonobos and chimpanzees has suggested that the great apes remember their friends and family even after years apart. They have basically carried out this experiment with Louise, a bonobo who participated in the study, recognizing her sister that she had last seen 26 years ago, in what is now evidence of the longest lasting non-human social memory in scientific record. There's various other different mentions of different chimps and things that the team has found about the kind of relationships shared by individuals, also influencing recognition and more positive relationship as group mates based on this as well. So, I mean, having worked with chimps and I know you have as well, this is no surprise, really.
No, not really. However, in light of the news article we covered a couple of weeks ago with the elephants actually using proper names, I'd like to see the same study carried out with elephants and vice versa, the names study carried out on chimps.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Coming to us from Cornwall Live, golden oriole, Cornwall sighting at Penzance of nearly extinct bird. In what will come as extremely exciting news to local Twitchers, the golden oriole, bird rendered extinct in the UK, was sighted in Penzance, Cornwall on Saturday, 13th of January. bird watchers and conservation groups alike were understandably over the moon.
I've got a less than ideal Devon-based animal story that has come from BBC, and it actually made me quite sad to read this. This is charity plea after giant tortoises found dead in Devon Forest. I saw this as it hit the news last night. An animal charity has issued an appeal for information after seven giant Aldabra tortoises were found dead in woodland near Exeter. Devon and Cornwall police say that the tortoises were found in Ashclist Forest on the National Trust's Killerton Estate. Two of the tortoises were found dead on the 8th of January, and a further five were found on Friday, police said. And just by looking at the photos that come with it, which are really not nice, because they are decent-sized tortoises. They're at least the size of... Their shell is at least the size of a piece of A4 paper. But you can see from the pictures as well, all of them have got really bad pyramiding. And, I mean, the fact that they were left to die on what has been some of the coldest nights this year so far, and that's not just saying because it's January, but has been absolutely freezing for a good couple of weeks around here. Who would do this? I mean, I'd gladly take that many Aldabra tortoises if it meant them dying or having somewhere to be warm. I just don't get why people would even start out with these things.
It's suggestive of something more sinister, perhaps.
Yeah. It's not nice at all.
Yeah.
Give us a news article that's slightly better.
I'm going to bring you back up with an article from Science Alert. World's rarest insect makes stunning comeback after near extinction. The Lord Howe Island stick insects exist on the precipice of oblivion, with a wild population numbering just under 30 individuals left. But thanks to the captive breeding efforts of San Diego Zoo, Melbourne Zoo, and the now closed Bristol Zoo, the tree lobsters now number in the thousands in captivity, representing a viable genetic reservoir.
Do you know where their only remaining group of them live in the wild? What the name of the bit of rock is? Because they no longer live on Lord Howe Island. They were eradicated by rats that got onto Lord Howe.
Yeah, I knew that they weren't on the island anymore. I don't know where they are now.
They're on, I think it's a brilliant named, basically it's a sea stack. It's a tiny spit of rock sticking out of the sea. They live on Ball's Pyramid.
Ball's Pyramid. Oh, yes, I did know that. I did know that.
Another
that
one.
Stuck out in my mind.
Another one fantastically covered by the Octonauts as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, from fizz.org, I've got nine new snail species discovered in Papua New Guinea, a biodiversity hotspot currently at risk. Nine new species of carnivorous land snail have been found on the remote forests of Papua New Guinea. And basically, the study has described this, all these new species, which are so small that all nine of these new species could, in fact, fit on a US nickel. Tiny little snails.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it makes carrying your samples very easily. You know, you describe a new elephant species, you need a truck to be able to turn up with your evidence. This, you just need your pocket.
Wow. Well, that's really melted my brain a bit there. So coming to us from science.org, my last article of the episode is that this is the oldest skin ever found. So a cave in Oklahoma has been at the center of paleontological intrigue this month, as 300 million-year-old skin has been discovered. The remains predate the oldest known fossilized skin by more than 20 million years and represent a Capterinus agouti specimen, which is an iguana-sized species of lizard-like reptile. Oklahoma is particularly enjoying this paleontological trophy, having been smashed in their game against my Los Angeles Lakers a few nights ago.
I knew you'd get something like that in there.
Stabby, stabby. And that wraps it up for this week's newsreel installment. Remember, if you guys have news that you would like us to cover, send them in. You can use any of the usual ways of contacting us, and you might see your chosen topic or news article covered here or in the main topic discussion. And with that said, Gareth has this week's main topic. Take it away.
Yes. This week I've got one from NPR, and it's usually... It's a topic I tend to steer away from, because as much as I like dinosaurs, I feel that tyrannosaurs tend to get all the headlines a lot of the time. And in fact, are, well, last week. Our main news
last
article
week was Tyrannosaur.
Was a yeah. Tyrannosaur as well. The debate as to...
2024 is off to a great start for me. I love
the debate as to whether Nanotyrannus was its own valid species or not, which it's not. But anyway, this has come from NPR, but it's all over in a variety of different places at the moment. Mm. A new paper has come out, sparking a new debate over the origins of tyrannosaurs, because a new tyrannosaur species has been described. That doesn't mean it's been dug up, because this one was dug up quite a few years ago, in fact, but this one has basically been redescribed in a new paper to actually come out as a brand new species of tyrannosaur. To give you an idea as well, this is called Tyrannosaurus macrensis. It's essentially the same size as a Tyrannosaurus rex. So for those of you who are wondering why or where does that come in, the genus name is Tyrannosaurus, and obviously the species name is macrensis, or the most familiar one that we all think of is Tyrannosaurus rex. And this
so,
is
Gareth, just a quick question there. I might be wrong, because I'm remembering this off of like off the top of my head here, but the five biggest theropods, doesn't that push them out so that now three of the top five are tyrannosaurs?
Yeah, because Lithrinax is another tyrannosaur. It's tyrannosaurs are big.
Very
big members of the carnivorous theropods. They're overpowered in so many ways. And it's why I tend to steer away from them. They really are. I like tyrannosaurs. I find them fascinating, but they get too much press. So
the family is great.
This is a rarity that I'm doing a tyrannosaur thing. But tyrannosaurs themselves, their lineage and where they come from, essentially, is really murky, because as with most things in the fossil record, there are big gaps. And this new species might help to basically help more, give more weight to the idea that tyrannosaurs are North American dinosaurs. There's been a lot of debate as to whether tyrannosaurs started out in North America and headed to Asia and then came back, or whether they started out in Asia and came to North. Basically, there's been a lot of debate over this. This is basically putting more of an idea that they were North American. This one comes from New Mexico, and this new paper that has been published in the scientific journal Nature has described the discovery of a relatively incomplete skull. It's quite fragmentary from this bed in New Mexico that was discovered in the 1980s. They've looked at it, and they have basically concluded that it's anatomically different enough that it deserves to be considered a new species. And they've looked at all the different parts of the jaw. There's some quite big differences between it and Tyrannosaurus rex. So they've been able to put forward that it should be a different species. It's got a shallower jaw than its cousins, indicating a less forceful bite. And according to one of the authors of the study, the New Mexican fossil also lacks ridges behind the eyes, a very distinctive feature of Tyrannosaurus rex. If you think of your classic T-Rex skull, it's got those little knobbly bits on the top of where its eyes are. Basically, think of them like eyebrows, I suppose. It would have allowed the animal to recognize members of its own species, these little knobbly bits on their head. So it definitely didn't have these. So it is quite different in a lot of ways. This newly identified tyrannosaur is said to predate T-Rex by about 6 to 7 million years, and rivals it in size of 40 feet, which is pretty much spot on as to what a T-Rex is. Tyrannosaurus macrensis adds new questions to the ongoing debate over the origins of Tyrannosaurus rex. T-Rex appeared in North America about 68 million years ago, right up to the end extinction event at the end of the Cretaceous, 66 million years ago. Its fossils have popped up in Montana, Wyoming, South Dakota. But until now, however, no close relatives of this species have been recognized in North America. You've got the quite close relative of Zootyrannus and Tyrannosaurus bartar, both in Asia, that are very, very similar, but are in Asia. They're in totally different parts of the world. And so it was quite hard to basically pinpoint where these guys should really fit in the evolutionary tree of the tyrannosaurs. Some in the field, however, are skeptical of the paper's findings, and there's a quote, "I hesitate to regard Tyrannosaurus macronensis as being distinct from Tyrannosaurus rex," Jared Voris has said, who studies tyrannosaur biology at the University of Calgary in Canada, but wasn't part of the study, he told New Scientist. There are a variety of other dissenters, and there always are when it comes to any kind of new fossil study. Essentially, if one person says one thing, another person will come out the next week and say another thing. So you can look forward to probably the rest of January 2024 going forward as a month of people arguing about tyrannosaurs in one form or another. I'm waiting for people to basically just have a big punch up as to what people think about them, especially because people will always have their opinions about Tyrannosaurus because it's such an iconic dinosaur. People love it for literally any reason. And you'll have people go, no, it can't be. I mean, you just have to look at any of those sort of things.
As someone who really, really likes the Tyrannosaur family, I can't get on board with that way of thinking. Like, I don't understand why people have to be that way about tyrannosaurs. They are fascinating in and of themselves.
You can't change their beloved idea of Tyrannosaurus rex. You can't be a scavenger in any way, shape, or form. Now, I don't completely buy the whole it was purely a scavenger thing, but
no, because
any
no
animal
sense,
will but take opportunities. But yeah, the amount of people go, no, it's T-Rex. It could never possibly scavenge. It only ate the finest pieces of meat. It only drank champagne, you know, all these sort of things.
There's no chance it ever had feathers at all in its entire life.
It was perfect at hunting.
It can't have lips.
Yeah, how dare you not shrink wrap my T-Rex? I like it so skinny, it looks like it's got anorexia.
How dare you portray it looking after its young?
It is not, it needs to be the savage killing machine that I
woke Tyrannosaurs.
Yeah. But yeah, there's always going to be someone who's going to complain. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we'll never 100% know on these things. We can only alter what we know based on the evidence that is present at the time. I can go with this being a new species of T-Rex based on the evidence that they've put forward. But if that changes next week, I'm happy to step aside with my opinions and just go with what is fact. But that's the fun about science. You always get to see something new every week and watch people fight each other over it, which is equally just as fun.
Yeah.
In fact, what we should do one time is just put T-Rex sucks on just a Facebook page.
Just to stay
just to see what happens. Just to bait people, see if they get into an argument. Because I'm sure that'll happen. Anyway, shall we move on from our news this week and head into our creature feature?
Let's do it.
It's the creature feature.
Right, well, we're into our creature feature for this week. Aaron, what are we looking at?
Well, we're looking back about 150 million years ago in the late Jurassic on an island, part of a chain that would today become known as Europe. A very important dinosaur once lived here that became a very important fossil. Now, during the heyday of this animal, this region of Europe was quite unrecognizable, but it is where you would consider South Germany to be. Aside from its position as part of an archipelago, this island would have been somewhat arid and yet somewhat broken into sections by a number of rivers flowing through it. Though trees seem to be few and far between in the fossil record for this area, cycads and conifers were the plants of the day, providing shelter from the elements, vantage points from which to hunt, and potentially options for resting at night. And such habitats were brimming with animal life too. You have the chicken-sized Compsognathus longpipes, busily scurrying across the substrate, probably hunting the various species of small lizard that are out basking in warm spots under the sun, and the air is filled with the buzzing of a wide array of insect species, all of which doing really well in this area at this time. All in all, it's the perfect place for a raven-sized predator to make its home, and thanks to exquisite fossil representations unearthed in the area, we know
quite a bit about Archaeopteryx. We know that Archaeopteryx had a sclerical ring comparable to modern day reptiles, including birds, that were of diurnal persuasion. We know that they could grow to sizes of about 0.5 meters in length, with a wingspan of 0.7 meters and a weight of about a kilogram at the very most. And we also know that it walked a thin line between avian theropod dinosaur and a non-avian theropod dinosaur. For example, the features it shared with other non-avian theropods include the fact that it had teeth and interdental plates, a long bony tail with long chevrons, an obturator process of the ischium, and a long ascending process of the ankle bone. It also had three functional digits on each forelimb, and each of these ended in a claw. On the other hand, the features it shared with avian theropods, the modern birds, include a partially reversed first toe, a wishbone, in case you've ever broken a wishbone of a chicken over your Christmas roast and made a wish with your grandparents. These guys would have had a wishbone too, and feathers, including genuine flight feathers. In fact, the plumage is so well evidenced in the fossil record that we actually know a lot about the feathers of Archaeopteryx. So
beautiful plumage.
So the head and neck appear to have either been bald in life, or the carcasses have begun to rot or otherwise degrade before the point of embedding in the sediment. We don't yet know which is the case, because whilst it is believable that the animal could have been a specimen with a bald head in life, the tendency for this species to be preserved with the neck bent downwards and evidence of looser soft tissues both suggest some degree of post-mortem travel and potentially rot. So it could either be that they look bold in the fossil record because they were bold, or because it just so happens coincidentally the head rotted first and left no evidence. The fossils display evidence of panaceous feathers covering at least partially the body of Archaeopteryx, indicating that the purpose of the feathers wasn't solely for insulation, but they needed a strong attachment potentially to tolerate the rigors of flight. The body also displays a fur-like down or proto-down as well, which again would aid in insulation. They did have well-developed flight feathers too, that could sustain some amount of true flight, with an asymmetric shape and a structure similar to that of modern birds, in that they display the same vane stability system, with the rachis, or main shaft of the feather, having branches called barbs fused to them. And these barbs have their own branches known as barbules. And each of these have tiny little hooks called barbicels, which function as a means to stitch it all together. And that is very reminiscent of modern birds. They also sported a pants-like covering of feathers on the legs. These appear to be similar in form to ratites. However, they're firm enough to have potentially supported flight too. So a lot of support going on here for the theory of them being able to fly. Researchers have even discovered the color of this wonderful plumage. So using scanning electron microscopy and energy dispersive X-ray analysis, melanosome structures were found in a feather described in 1861. These were then compared to 87 extant bird species to reveal that it's 95% likely that the feather was black. It was further hypothesized that the feather was entirely black, with an even darker pigmentation of the black towards the tip. Now, whilst this feather doesn't in itself prove that Archaeopteryx was completely black in color, it does support another theory that we've touched on, flight. It seems that melanosome structures for black feathers actually produce stronger feathers, aiding in flight. A further study by Ryan Carney and colleagues, the graduate who carried out the first color study on the feather, it was published in Scientific Reports in 2020, which is a science journal. This study revealed that the black of the feather was a matte shade of black, and there was no evidence for patterns or iridescence. Unlike, I think Microraptor was black and iridescent.
yeah, sort of Starling. Starling, yeah,
Starling. Also, some of the black feathers on magpies are iridescent as well.
Yeah.
So where does Archaeopteryx sit? Is it avian or is it non-avian?
I imagine it sits in a tree, really.
yes, a tree would be a very fine place for it to sit. But to understand where it sits in its lineage, let's first dive into the confusion paleontological history of Archaeopteryx. So first discovered in 1860 and described a year later, Archaeopteryx was initially known by just one isolated feather, the one that we mentioned earlier. This is currently housed in the Natural History Museum of Berlin. It was originally described by Hermann von Meyer and was considered the holotype specimen. The first skeleton, on the other hand, was recovered from Langenalheim in Germany. It was then sold to its current custodians, the Natural History Museum in London, for £700. Which by today's standards would be about £83,000. By the way, they actually
a bargain there.
Yeah, they actually think that the seller was a physician who was gifted this this fossil in return for medical services, which I thought was an interesting side note.
Get paid in fossils. I like it.
Paid in fossils. Yeah, I'd be happy to. Not all the time, obviously, but I wouldn't mind doing a job for a nice fossil, maybe.
Well, yeah, but to be paid in a priceless, beautiful, one of a kind fossil would I think would do me any day.
Yeah, and not just one of a kind. I've said it on this podcast before that I firmly believe that Archaeopteryx is the single most important fossil ever found. There are plenty of important fossils, not just from the time of the dinosaurs, but and it's just opinion, but I think, in my opinion, the Archaeopteryx fossil is the single most important one because of what it has to tell us about dinosaurs and about birds and about life and evolution and that.
Mm.
Well, actually, let's go off on a tangent a second. What would you say is the most important fossil?
You know what, Aaron? I think we should actually save that as a question.
Okay. Put
out. I think we should definitely save that because that will be quite a good one to get everyone's opinion. I'll withhold my opinion as to what I think for the moment. But yeah, I think we should definitely pose that as a question at some point.
I'm happy with that. That sounds like a good idea. So we'll get back to our feathered friends here. So following the discovery and the sale of this fossil of Archaeopteryx, a further 12 fossilized skeletons started coming in. Sorry, I've got that wrong. I tell a lie. A further 11 fossilized skeletons started coming in, each hinting that the relationship of the original feather that was described with the species we were finding in these skeletons may not be as it seems. Richard Owen reflected this in his 1863 description of the London specimen of Archaeopteryx, naming it Archaeopteryx macrura to differentiate between the two examples. And this discovery would later be interpreted in Charles Darwin's fourth edition of On the Origin of Species as indicative of how little we know compared to how much we thought we knew about prehistoric life. And actually, Charles Darwin has this, I haven't written it down here, but it's very easy to find. He has this beautiful passage about Archaeopteryx and what it means. In relation to this fossil, so I do recommend looking that up. Today, despite 12 specimens being described and 10 names being published for this species, only two species are legitimately considered, and even they have a really complex history. So Archaeopteryx lithographica is represented solely by that original isolated feather specimen. In 1954, Gavin De Beer proposed that the London specimen was in fact the holotype as opposed to the original feather, seeing as it was the first fossilized skeleton found. And the International Code on Zoological Nomenclature agreed to this and to and also to Swinton's proposal that Archaeopteryx lithographica be part of the official genera list and actively suppressing the many names for this species. And there was actually a little bit of a tit for tat between a couple of these characters involved. It was also interesting, but not really relevant to this creature feature. It's another example of the continuation of the Bone Wars, where people were kind of naming many things to give themselves notoriety and also using the naming of new species to kind of take little pot shots at each other. But yeah, very interesting to look into. But as I mentioned, Richard Owen and others later wanted to differentiate between the feather and the fossilized skeletal remains due to a suspect relationship between the two. And I wanted to dive into that just briefly, because it turns out that this feather actually doesn't correspond well with the feathers on the fossilized skeletons at all. And it is agreed that the feather is from a contemporary feathered, as yet unknown dinosaur species, but that the dimensions and proportions are not a match for what we now know of Archaeopteryx. So it turns out that feather is probably not an Archaeopteryx feather in the first place. As a result of this, and as a result of it being the original Archaeopteryx in name at least, the feather could bring about severe confusion as to how to name which specimens belong where. And as a result, the London specimen has now been named the type specimen for Archaeopteryx. The classification of which specimens fit where and just how species are or are not different remains an impassioned debate with regards to Archaeopteryx, even to this day. There's a lot of... it's very much... It might not be as heated because it's potentially not as charismatic a species, but it is certainly as contested and argued over as your Spinosaurus debate and the Tyrannosaurus versus Nanotyrannus debates are very much kind of that level of disagreement and discussion, but perhaps not quite as heated. But that history of confusion leads us rather awkwardly into where they sit today. It took a long time for anyone to agree on which species was the type specimen, and perhaps longer still to position the feather and the skeletons in relation to each other. And we don't even need to begin to wrap our heads around the various species that may or may not exist. But it doesn't seem as though their relationship to dinosaurs, avian or non-avian, is quite so straightforward either. They're widely believed to be the most primitive bird and yet not thought to be the actual true ancestor of modern birds, only a relative of that ancestor. And there are almost as many theories as there are authors to propose them, with some believing that Archaeopteryx belongs to the Deinonychosaurs and others nominating that Maniraptorans were extremely bird-like generally, and so modern birds could have actually multiple lineages to descend from, and thus different bird groups have different ancestral species. So there's potentially a situation going on where even birds aren't one bird group is not actually related to other bird groups, which is interesting. So I with all that said, I've very very briefly touched on one of the main kind of topics for discussion and argument when it comes to Archaeopteryx, and I wanted to end it on a very brief discussion about it, and that is of course the subject of flight. I've pretty much presented the anatomical data as best as we know at this time, but just to reiterate so it's fresh in our memories here, they had pinaceous feathers across the body, including those asymmetrical and specialized for flight. Very much the same as in modern birds. They had that wishbone structure that modern birds have. They had a light build, with legs lacking the secondary wing of many other similar at a glance species like your Microraptor. And further to this, the tail feathers were broad, which is another trait indicative of a feather structure intended for lift generation. And CT scans of the brain case indicate that the brain size necessary for flight was present when you compare body size to brain size, especially when you then take that that size ratio and compare it to other dinosaurs, and indeed birds and closest bird dinosaur relatives around today, crocodiles too. However, just to throw a spanner in the works here for us, they did lack a breastbone. Now, in case you didn't know, the breastbone in modern birds, it acts as
quite
kind
an important part of the anatomy.
It's, very important. It kind of anchors the flight muscles and provides a lot of power. Without this, it's likely that Archaeopteryx probably couldn't achieve the pattern of flight demonstrated by modern birds. So, if
out of interest, Aaron, and this may be something that you're not aware of, I don't know. Have they found any evidence for the attachments for the supercaracoideus muscle?
Oh, I read something about the supercaracoideus muscle. Give me a second. I'll have a quick gander.
I'll give a quick rundown for those of you who are unaware of what the supercaracoideus is, whilst Aaron frantically searches for that. So in avian flight, you have two major groups of muscles that are responsible for the upstroke and the downstroke. The first one being obviously the breast muscle, which is anchored to the keel, otherwise known as the breastbone, at the front. So if you've ever eaten a chicken or something, that's where the meat is attached to. That helps with the downstroke, but to be able to pull the arm back up, instead of having massive biceps and triceps, which they still have to an extent, they have a muscle called the supercaracoideus, which attaches and loops over the
it attaches to the plate like coracoids, and I believe it's part of the shoulder joint and all that as well. So you've got
acts
your
like a pulley.
Coracoids, and then you've got your scapula and humerus, and actually in Archaeopteryx, these things are actually oriented almost kind of sideways, like I don't think horizontal is the right word, but if you imagine sideways anyway,
it was less likely it would have had true flapping flight and more gliding flight.
Modern birds, theirs are arranged kind of in a dorsal kind of way, a lot more upright, and that's what allows birds. I was about to say about the flight pattern of birds, if you've ever seen a bird's flight slowed down, you'll notice that their wings go through this beautiful kind of figure of eight kind of shape, where the wing actually loops up, and at its highest point is actually above the top of the back of the bird, so they're kind of reaching back. So Archaeopteryx, because of this, because of their arrangement, they're unable to do that, so they can't do that upward arc of the wing flap. That being said, there was a study in 2006 that that proposed that Archaeopteryx was unable to use flapping flight as modern birds do, but it would have had a pretty strong downstroke only kind of, as you say, gliding technique. However, a counter argument to that is that there is potential for if these muscles that are attached to the breastbone in modern birds, if they were in fact attached at the wishbone and perhaps in the shoulders too, in a slightly different manner, that they could still have achieved flight, but a different kind of flying stroke, shall we say. And that has led to suggestions that in even more recent studies that the modern birds and the species like Archaeopteryx actually have two separate but no less truer or falser versions of flying, two different techniques of flight stroke in order to achieve true flight, which is possible. But again, it's hotly debated and contested. Just going to flick back over to over here to where we were. I was seeing how they, so essentially what I was saying, they lack the breastbone, and but it could be that these muscles are anchored to the wishbone. It's also possible that there is a cartilage sternum, a cartilage version of the breastbone, in effect, that hasn't fossilized, hasn't preserved. That is a potential theory there. But another point of contention, so another point against flight, is that the shape of the wings themselves, they display these short, rounded shape to the wings that would increase drag, whilst the large surface area of the wing would actually reduce the turning radius and set the stall speed relatively low. So again, not looking good for flight on that aspect, but there's actually a counter argument to that too, because having wings shaped in such a way would actually be an advantage for flying through the denser areas of its range. So as you can, Gareth, you're very familiar with Archaeopteryx, but as you can hear from that very quick summary there, that quick kind of overview of what we've been through over the course of this creature feature, the boat seems to be, the jury seems to be very much out on this discussion. There's strong support for flight. There's strong support for gliding. There's strong support for not being able to achieve either, actually. There's also theories that support the idea that these animals were built for running very fast on the ground. And then that theory itself backs up another theory of the origin of flight, in that instead of being the ground up approach, so birds evolved to fly because they were running to whether to catch prey or whether to get away from the predators.
In similar veins to or the best way to explain it, and certainly how I've explained it in the past, is using the song Seagull, Stop It Now, run 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 jump, I could be your backpack while you run. But no, that wouldn't come. But yeah, small feathery dinosaur running on the floor, trying to catch small lizards or insects, jumps and finds it can stay in the air that little bit longer and gives it that little bit more advantage to jump over gaps and things. But then there's equally the tree down approach, which is the small dinosaur that can climb up and then throws itself off to try and catch things midair.
And the ones that glide the furthest tend to, and at the furthest and the fastest, catch the prey and
I prefer to think of the tree down method, because it also works from a predator evasion point of view.
Yeah,
and a lot of animals today use that as a method of escape. So cockroaches, which seems like a really odd thing to throw it to, are a really good example, because a lot of species of cockroach are quite not good at flight, but they can do it. And it is basically their way of avoiding predators up in a tree. So if a spider comes towards them or a lizard comes towards them to try and grab them, they just throw themselves off and they use their wings to help slow their descent. And I see, Microraptor and Archaeopteryx doing similar things. So something in the tree comes after them, whether it's a mammal or a reptile or whatever, and they just throw themselves out of the tree to escape.
Another example that might get people thinking along those lines is sugar gliders, the way that they launch themselves and glide down. So clearly we're both in agreement that we think that bird flight may have evolved from the tree down approach. However, that doesn't answer necessarily where we stand on Archaeopteryx's ability. Now, I will say that I think that Microraptor, the evidence is strong for Microraptor being one of these gliders and not getting true flight. However, I fall in the other boat when it comes to Archaeopteryx. I'd be interested to hear what you think. I think Archaeopteryx may have been able to fly. I mean, my mind is open to further evidence, because tomorrow they might come out and they might have really compelling reasons Firstly, the reasons for it not being able to fly are thoroughly compelling, and the reasons for it being able to fly are thoroughly compelling. There's not really anything to lose by standing by either one of them, and then when new evidence emerges, being an adult about it and changing my mind. But I think
Aaron, we're on the internet.
Oh yeah,
we should be going one opinion. And nail our colours to that mast and die on that hill.
Thump the table and refuse
reality and any changes to that reality based on new evidence.
Yeah. Personally, I think the evidence for Microraptor being a glider and not a flyer are too strong to deny. But with Archaeopteryx, I think you could go either way. And for the moment, I swing towards flight.
I do not.
Interesting.
I'm in the gliding camp with this one because I think the lack of a breastbone, a prominent one, it doesn't allow proper powered flight in the truest sense. This is the dinosaur equivalent, like Microraptor, of a flying squirrel or a sugar glider. It is doing that same sort of thing. It's using its feathers to keep itself warm, but it's also using its feathers for that gliding purpose. I don't see this being an animal that is capable of sitting on the ground and flapping and getting into the air any more than a lot of other animals, you know, that would have similar abilities. But I think of them, I mean, obviously bats don't have breastbones and they're able to fly, but they have a very different setup to how they're able to get off the ground as well. And I could imagine Microraptor. I can imagine an Archaeopteryx on the ground could actually be quite a fragile and quite delicate thing that would be.
I would have thought so.
Picked off. So.
That's good. We're in agreement about Microraptor, though, aren't we? Definitely a glider.
That's
good. I think that's pretty healthy. Because our listeners can, if Archaeopteryx ever comes up again in the news or what have you, our listeners have one person who is in the glider court and one person who's in the flight court.
So we're always going to be 100% on this. You know, we're always going to have the answer if we cover. You go one way, I'll go the other.
Yeah.
And we'll always be right collectively as a podcast. I think that's the way to do it. Yeah.
Also, it leads to some healthy discussion. I do hope that there's more to come from the Archaeopteryx fossil record. But before we finish this off, this is something that I found really interesting. It's a video that you and I have seen before, but it came back up again in the algorithms because I was looking for the origin of flight, the origin of feathers, Archaeopteryx, and other dinosaurs that are similar and that. And it's worth shouting out PBS Eons are the ones that came up with this video. And it's a fantastic video. But I think it's worth pointing out how infinitely weird birds are. So birds, the reason I say this is
compared to our mammal sensibilities, I suppose.
No, I don't mean it like that. I mean it in terms of flight, because you look at all the other animals that have developed flight, and birds, the dinosaurs that flew, and the birds, the avian dinosaurs that are still around today, they're the only ones with feathers. And dinosaurs themselves tried other ways of flight, other methods of flight. They tried the bat wing method.
Yeah, Yeechi and...
Yeechi and Ambopteryx longibrachium. And there are actually more and more of those being found. So it clearly was an avenue they were exploring. And then you've also got the pterosaurs. They were wing membranes, skin membranes.
But they were covered in very similar integument known as sphygnofibers, which is
but
like
the wings
hair.
Weren't the wings
they
were naked.
They were covered to a little bit like a fuzz. We're not talking like shaggy things, but...
Well, I know that the body was, but I'm pretty we might have to look this up between the two of us, but I'm pretty sure the actual skin membrane itself was next to naked or or pretty much somewhat similar to, you know, like a bat, the fur of a bat. But they did have this proto feather body plumage that would have resembled fur, but it was actually feathers.
Figno fibers.
Yeah. It just is interesting that, and again, if you look at, and again, look at insects and any mammals that come close to flying that aren't bats. So again, your sugar gliders and flying squirrels.
There aren't others that do true powered flight.
No, but the attempts to get there or to mimic that behavior. And birds or the feathered dinosaurs are the only ones that use the feathers. It's just an interesting thing.
Feathers themselves are an absolute amazing evolutionary quirk that have come from scales. Mm. But then again, if you look at hair in itself, it's a true amazing evolutionary quirk that's come from scales.
Yeah.
You end up with hairs on things like polar bears, which are hollow, trapping heat. You look at hairs on something like an aardvark on their nose. They're able to use them to detect pressure and things like that. Cats' whiskers are modified hairs.
Yeah, yeah.
And they can judge distance. So they all came originally from scales, from reptilian ancestry. So I think birds are, well, all life is amazing in the sense that it's developed its own characteristics and then changed what the base thing is, the base hair, the base feather, to what is needed. You know, you end up with all this variation, which is just makes life infinitely more interesting to look at.
Oh yeah, the colors of life is just
it's the whole Brian Cox moment, you know, the wonders of feathers.
Well, that's Archaeopteryx.
Very nice, one of my favorite dinosaurs. And one of those classic ones that was always in every dinosaur book as the, this is the new dinosaur. You know, all those kids' dinosaur books that you and I probably grew up with, where it's scaly monsters biting chunks out of each other. Yeah. And then one random picture of an Archaeopteryx where it just looks like the most angry lizard bird that they could, you know, imagine. They couldn't quite get the idea right. And it was always bright yellow with blue feathers on the ends of the wings.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know who picked the colors, but they went, yeah, we'll go with that. It might actually be a holdover from one of the Charles Knight pictures, you know, from one of his murals in the Carnegie Museum in America.
Mm.
But I don't know. Well, should we move on from the Solhofen limestone that is... the creature feature and go and wade into the other parts? I don't know, that's going nowhere, is it?
The murky depths of the emails.
Should we move on from the Jurassic period and head into our emails?
Let's do it.
Let's do this.
Bing! You've got mail.
Ooh, it's an email. Okay, well, we're into this week's emails. We'll start things off by going over the question from last week, which was, if you could have any natural history-based qualification, what would you want? What would you want to acquire? There are quite a few answers, actually, on this one. Jen Babs has put an MSc in paleontology, probably biomechanics of brachiosaurs. So, you know, nice and easy one, that one. Tom had put an MSc in paleoecology, specializing in late quaternary herbivores. I mean, everyone has got a real idea of what they want to go with. This is quite good. Karen Kuhn Wright has put embryology. I want either genetically to engineer an iguana to have wings instead of front legs, or lengthen telomeres in dogs and cats so that they live way longer and age much slower. So you're either going for creating dogs that live a lot longer or making an iguana dragon. So, I like it. Pete Watts has put astronaut, definitely. And my other half has put genetics, anything above a bachelor's. Right. Well, there you go. Some fairly good answers there as to what everyone wants to do. Everyone's got a good idea. So, here's hoping that, well, you get to study that. I'd love to go and do more study of things, but it's having the time and evidently the money is always the issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, well, based on the fact that I was saying earlier in the start of this week's episode, how I've been playing Path of Titans, that dinosaur game, this week's question I thought would be quite good to go with is, what's your favorite animal or nature-based game? That could be board game. It could be computer game. Aaron, what's your one? And it doesn't have to be what you're currently playing or anything. I would say it could be just whatever you've always enjoyed. I'd say Planet Zoo and Zoo Tycoon are also on there for me.
So Planet Zoo is the one that I most want to play right now. I haven't played it. It looks incredible. Path of Titans, again, is one that we've spoken about. That
I was
going to really
say, you need
play.
To join me. I'm wandering around a map as a...
I am going to, and just waiting for payday on that.
I was all lonely and just wandering around and then getting eaten by things or dying of starvation.
I think my favorite one, though, Zoo Tycoon 1 would be in third place. Zoo Tycoon 2 would be in second place. And in first place, much to the pain of Drew.
Oh, you're not. You're not. No. Oh, come on.
I like that game. And I just started playing it again this week, actually, with Atta. And we're thoroughly enjoying it.
Right. You definitely need to get that Path of Titans then, because it's better than Ark in so many ways. It looks visually better.
Yeah, it definitely looks better. But I enjoy it. I don't like all the little monsters that are that play the game online.
Well, that's the problem.
Not the creatures. I mean the people. But no, and also it has some issues. But
a lot of issues.
It's not perfect, but it's. I think the good outweighs the bad on it. There was one game that I always wanted to play. I think it was announced in like 2006, and it was coming to PS3. In fact, it was announced as a launch title for PS3, but it only ever ended up coming out in Japan and North America, much to my frustration. It was a game called Africa. And basically, it was a lot like Pokemon Snap, just with better graphics. basically, you're in Africa, and you're a photographer. And the whole point, you know those games, those hunting games where you have to hunt a big game and shoot them? Essentially that, but you're shooting them with a camera, not with a gun. And you've got your trophies, your challenges, your awards, everything. The whole system is based off of you getting these beautiful photos of these animals, but it never came out in the UK, so I never got to play it.
Never even heard of it.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, nowadays the graphics would be dated, but at the time, for PS3, it looked great.
Never got to play it. I'm going to have to say there's two categories for this for me. One is going to have to be a computer game, and that definitely goes to Planet Zoo. The hours, the absolute hours I've spent on that game, building the most mundane and or completely unrelated to even an animal enclosure things on it, like building a kiosk or something, or building a visitor center, or in fact, probably the one that took me the longest and had the least to do with what it was actually set up for was the vet building that I made that had elephant and giraffe skeletons in like an atrium at the front, where you could then view into the area where the surgical area was. None of this was actually usable in the game. It's all just completely decorative. The actual vet building bit that you get for the game, it's sort of in it. It's its own module. But you know, there's people who've made like all these different things online and put them in there. I got excited when somebody had made like a sack truck online, and you could put that in there. And building a warehouse for my of equipment for my elephant house, so it was more realistic that it had like a storage area for like tires and boxes with different bits of bake enrichment and things in there. So that just, it's a game where you can spend hours setting up an enclosure. The most intricate enclosure that I built on it was my Lions of Savo enclosure, which had,
oh yeah,
it had the train station, well, as close to as I could make from Ghost in the Darkness, the Man-Eaters of Savo. So the whole thing was basically set up. So this enclosure was basically, you would follow a path through the scrub with lots of different signs about the lions and Savo lions and how they're slightly different from a lot of the other lions in Africa. And then you'd walk into the train station, and the way that the enclosure is set up is half of the building is... No, sorry, it wasn't the train station. It was a train carriage. You'd get into the train. The visitors would go into the train carriage. Half of the train carriage the lions could get into, and half the public could get into, so that you get that whole view of things. And the rest of the enclosure is set up so that there is a, you know, the train line goes through it, and there's a bridge being built. Like, if you've ever seen the film, highly recommend it. Not 100% close to reality, but still a very good film based on actual events. And the actual enclosure took me ages to build, just purely for lions. Possibly one of the most, you're not going to like me for saying it, but boring zoo animal enclosures that most of the time are featured. You know, most zoos have boring lion enclosures. So yeah, the idea of having an animal that most of the time, I never have lions in my zoo because they don't interest me that much. But having the, you know, they weren't actually Savo lions, but it was just lions set up to look like the Lions of Savo. Yeah, so really fantastic game. Couldn't recommend it highly enough if you have a computer that can run it. And the only other one, board game wise, I think is definitely worth mentioning is it's a game called Evolution. It's quite good. You've played it with me before, Aaron. Board game where you basically evolve your creature. In fact, myself and Drew used to play it quite a lot when we lived in the same house. And he decided one time to make people as his creature, and essentially he wiped out all other life on the planet. It's like, well, this is just too close to reality. So yeah, he won that round. But yeah, those are two of my favorites, I'd say.
It does ring a bell. I, on the subject of Planet Zoo, there is a game that narrowly missed out on being on my list, but I will mention it. And the reason why it didn't end up, I do enjoy this game, or I did enjoy this game quite a bit. It's Jurassic World Evolution.
And it's made by the same people, but yeah.
This is why it didn't make the list in the end, is because it's made by the same people with Planet Zoo. And everything good about Planet Zoo, everything that you say about Planet Zoo, every good point that you made is basically a bad point in Jurassic World Evolution for the fact that it's missing. It's so uncustomizable. It's so linear. It's so...
That's because it was a title that was made for consoles. It was never made to be anything more than that.
That and the licensing.
And the fact that
it's licensed to, you know, Universal and the Jurassic World franchise, but which I understand, but it did, like, and it was... You know, you could tolerate it until Gareth and Drew started talking about all this stuff you could do in Planet Zoo that was made by the same developers.
And then Aaron and then got jealous.
I never picked up that game again.
I think once you completed it, it wasn't as good. But yeah.
Well, once you've done one island, you've done them all, to be honest. But there you go.
Right, well, shall we move on? Aaron, do we have any emails this week?
Do you know what? Hot off the press, this came in whilst we were recording.
Oh.
So it comes to us from one of our fantastic Patreon supporters, Jen Greenhall, and she writes to us a really lovely bit of feedback, actually. She says, hello, lovelies, watching Winter Watch, and to be honest, whatever Chris and Michaela are saying about the Portuguese Man of War, I already knew, thanks to your amazing podcast. That's Chris Packham and Michaela Strachan, for those that don't
know. That started this evening, I think.
She continues, so can I nominate you for the awards that they are talking about? Also, I reckon I could oust Michaela. you need a shout out on the watches. Well, I don't know what award they're talking about.
We're recording this probably as it's actually on. So
I'm not sure what this award is. But if we're eligible for awards, we'd love to get them. If you'd like,
we'd love to get either Chris Packham or Michaela Strachan on the.
I don't know what awards that you're talking about, but just to get a shout out on the watches would be fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, we're never going to say no to things like that.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, as emails go, that's pretty up to date. Although obviously by the time this comes out, it will be a week old. Thank not just Jen Greenhall, but the rest of our Patreons for being, the supporters of the podcast that they are. Aaron, do you want to read out our names of our Patreons and what voice are you doing it in this week?
I think I'll go easy on myself this week and do Smeagol.
Okay.
So the princess would like to thank Teresa McKee, yes, and Bonnie Peel, and John Greenhall, and Frog Tuber.
I hope that comes out well across the microphone. I hope it works well on the microphone.
It sounded good. Yeah.
Okay.
It's truly creepy when he does that, especially if he peers out of nowhere and does it.
I do have a penchant for sneaking up on people when they cut, not noticing and just jumping at them, screaming.
Very sneaky. But yes, so those are our patrons who support us financially on Patreon. But there are multitudes of ways that you can obviously support us and help us out just by listening. And you've already done an amazing job by sticking with us to the end of the episode. You can also tell a friend, tell an enemy. Go to the Solhofen Limestone in Germany and shout at some Bavarians in a beer tent, I guess. I don't know. So, interestingly enough, Aaron, did you know that our sixth highest listenership country-wise is, in fact, Germany? So, So there hopefully are some people in Bavaria listening as we speak or when this comes out.
Well, in that case, Gareth,
the Solhofen Limestone and the Solhofen area.
I'd just like to say guten Tag to our German listeners, and I hope they enjoyed this episode on the Urvogel.
Ooh, the Urvogel? Is that the German name for Archaeopteryx?
That's the German name for Archaeopteryx, and I believe it means ancient wing.
Oh, so Archaeopteryx then.
Mm-hmm.
Basically. Tell a friend, tell an enemy, like say, some people in Bavaria. You can also like, subscribe, or leave a review on whatever podcasting service you're listening to us on. Podcasts live and die on the word of mouth, and you do more than you know by telling people about us and or nominating us on some sort of award on Winterwatch. So feel free to do that as well. But that pretty much brings us to the end of this week's episode. So Aaron, big thank you for coming along. Don't act surprised. You knew you were here.
that was a bit awkward, wasn't it?
A little bit.
Thank you for having me. Danke schön, I should say.
Oh, very good. And a big thank you to you at home for listening. And we'll see you next time here in the Natural History Cupboard. Bye.
Auf Wiedersehen. One does not simply evolve flight.